Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Quanta Quarter One 2021 Lender Call, hosted by Ian Griffiths, Deputy Chief Executive Officer and Group Finance Director. My name is Sheila, I'm the operator for the call today. During the presentation, your lines will remain on listen only. If you require assistance at any time, just use star zero on your telephone and a coordinator will be happy to help you. I would like to advise all parties this conference is being recorded. I'd like to hand over to Ian. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Sheila. Hello, everyone, and thank you very much for joining us for this Quanta Quarter One results call, plus our credit update of where we are today. On the call, you've got myself, Ian Griffiths, as Sheila said. I'm Quanta's Deputy CEO and CFO, and Peter Russell, who's our Group Treasurer. If we just move on a couple of slides, we've got to show the disclaimer because we need to, and then just the agenda so you can see what we're going to cover today. Firstly, you're going to get an overview from myself and Peter on Quanta, where we are. We've also included a couple of slides, just overview slides, to remind everyone of who we are and what we do. We're going to talk about our Numerator acquisition, not least because the required antitrust clearance has now been obtained, so we expect to close this transaction within the first half of Q3. We'll then go through our detailed Q1 trading, an update on Numerator's trading, including within that section, a combined pro forma of the two businesses, and then hopefully end with some Q&A at the end. If you just move on, Peter. Couple of slides. Next one, thank you. In our last call, we said we were entering 2021 with a fair degree of optimism based on our order book, our revenue momentum, and the work that we've done on costs and cash, and in particular, working capital management. That optimism remains firmly in place, and we can see positive signs on all key measures, whether it's revenue, our orders, margins, and cash management, both in terms of what's been delivered in Q1, but what's continuing into Q2. We've had a much stronger start to the year than we expected. Revenues are up 3% versus 2020, and pretty much back in line with 2019. Six out of our seven businesses had year-on-year growth. We've seen really strong growth in China, which is up 31%. India was up 19%. Even bigger, more mature markets like the U.K., where growth has been a challenge historically, have delivered 14% growth in Q1. Our Worldpanel business is delivering double-digit revenue growth in Q1, and this is after growing every quarter last year. Our Public business has delivered 34% growth, largely in the U.K. It's important that the areas where we invested through the uncertainty of last year, our so-called growth platforms, are now starting to really deliver. They had 45% growth in Q1, mainly from APG, our automated brand tracking tool, Marketplace, our self-serve platform, and our analytics business, which is run out of the U.S. and India. That's a really good, strong start on revenues. On the profit side, we've seen all of that revenue upside flow through to improved EBITDA, which at $118 million is up nearly 60% on 2020 and up around 50% on 2019, which as I say, is on roughly the same level of revenues. This is because all of the work done last year on the cost base, where we removed excess capacity, any inefficiencies, and starting to simplify the business, is now coming through clearly in our results. Headcount is around 3,800 lower than 12 months ago, and as you'll see, there are further efficiencies to deliver. We've also stayed very focused on working capital. The new ways of working we introduced last year continue to deliver, and we've reduced working capital by $225 million versus last year and a further $50 million versus where we ended 2020. Peter's going to cover the details of that later, but it underpins our healthy liquidity position and our strong cash position. Those who've listened to previous calls will have heard us talk about repositioning and reshaping the portfolio and investing for the future. The sale of our specialist health business has now been substantially completed, and it's exciting to have the support to be strengthening the core of the business with the Numerator acquisition, which we'll talk about in a minute. At its heart, it's a brilliant complement to our Worldpanel business, creating a global footprint in understanding shopper behavior. As I said, now that we're through the regulatory side of things, we think this is firmly on track to close in the first half of Q3. It also remains equally important that we continue to execute well across the rest of the business, and we remain very focused on cost and cash. So we've identified total cost savings of $320 million at a run rate, much higher than was originally thought when the business was acquired by Bain Capital, and we'll go through the detail of that later. But with plans in place for savings being implemented of another $170 million, it will benefit future periods. And this will come from procurement, further offshoring, automation, and further efficiencies across our ways of working, which makes us a better business for employees, our suppliers, and our customers. And then finally, in terms of the outlook, because of the nature of the revenues we've got pretty good visibility across the rest of the year. We have around two-thirds of our target revenues for the full year already secured by signed orders or contracts. Our bookings for the next 30 days, 90 days, and the rest of the year are all nicely ahead of historic averages. And in the months, over the last few months, we've delivered more work than we've delivered in any of the previous 3 years, which is why when we look at Q2, we're very confident we'll deliver strong double-digit revenue growth, and that's helped by April closing with 18% growth year on year. So this has been a good start to the year with positive momentum on the top line, a tight grip on costs and cash, and this helps as we plan forward, and in particular, gives us the confidence to invest in a business like Numerator, which we'll now talk through. But before I do that, these two slides that are coming up now are really for reference. So a couple of slides really just to remind you what the business is and why Bain Capital invested and the potential they saw. Yeah, in summary, In summary, this is a business that's very cash generative, it's globally diverse, it's data-driven, it's research and measurement business with a very strong client base, where our top 10 clients in Q1 were only 13% of our revenue. And our data is embedded in our clients' decision-making processes, it's highly recurring, but it's also a business that has maintained a strong market-leading position, despite being underinvested in for several years, and that creates the opportunity. We've got relationships with 92 of the top 100 global advertisers. We deal with 60% of Fortune 500. And we're number one and number two in 9 of our top 10 markets. The exception to that is the US. And the Numerator deal really strengthens our position in that market. And the following slide just shows how we run the business in terms of the divisions that we have, the 6 divisions. As you'll see, Insights is roughly half our revenues, a business that really helps clients understand and manage their brands. We measure brand perception, customer needs, competitive position. We help on innovation and new product launches. We support on campaign effectiveness for media. We test their advertising. We look at their customer experience. Our world panel businesses are hidden gems. It's the currency in many of its markets. It's tracking shopper behavior, which you'll hear more of in a minute. That's exactly what Numerator does in the US market. We're essentially measuring, explaining, and advising brand-owning clients of what's happening to their products. And then the other big business is media, which is principally our audience measurement business with long-term 5 to 7 year contracts, and an advertising intelligence business which is collecting market share and market data across all media, which is again a business very similar to what Numerator has. So we still get the useful reminders of who we are, what we do. If you move on, Peter, to the next couple of slides, and we'll talk a little bit more about the Numerator business. But just starting with a bit of context. In 2019, Bain Capital invested in Kantar based on the strong fundamentals in the research market. And Kantar having a strong position in that market with, as I said, a global footprint and a great customer base, but recognizing the need and opportunity to reshape, reposition and drive value from what has been an undermanaged business. In 2020, probably not quite the year everyone expected, but we made real progress. And if anything, we probably made more progress than we thought. We did more work on costs, more work on the portfolio. We introduced new ways of working, new talent was brought into the team, and we continued to invest for growth. And in 2020, we really appreciated the quality of our wall panel business, which was resilient all the way through the year with growth, as I said, in every quarter. Not least because clients and brands need to know who's buying what, where, how, especially when times are changing, and clearly in 2020 times are changing really quickly. As we look ahead, we want a business that's more locked into helping brand owners understand their business and products. And to do that, we need trusted data and great analytics. If we get that right, we create more recurring revenues, clients keep coming back, and once a client is in, we can upsell extra products and extra value. That's the plan, and Numerate and Wallpanel are key parts of doing exactly what I've just said. We move on. Many on the call may know bits of Numerate or even know Numerate itself. It's a combination of two businesses. It's a North American shop apparel business and their so-called PAS business, which is a data monitoring and measurement business, primarily for advertising promotions. As I say, very similar to our ad intelligence business in our media domain, our media division. And there are synergies we can unlock, especially on the PAS business, but the growth and value is really the panel business, which is now over half the revenue for Numerator and has grown at 58% compound through 2018 to 2020. And this growth momentum, as we'll show you later, is continuing. The panel business is driven by technology, the data is collected by a mobile phone app, similar to what we're using for World Panel Plus, and delivered to clients on a SaaS platform, sold as a recurring subscription, with additional features and functions added on as upsell. Around 95% of revenues in this business are recurring or reoccurring. And the fit with Kantar, especially WorldPanel, we think, is really compelling. Move on. This just breaks down the business a little bit more. But as you can see, the exciting part of the business for us, given the trajectory and its growth and the potential scale and fit with Kantar, is the panel business. The business already has strong client base. It has the highest NPS scores of any research business we've seen and scores highly on propensity for non-clients to switch and highly on key purchase criteria. All of that's very reassuring as we look at future growth. Their survey business, which is a self-serve business off the same panel, is really interesting as a growth opportunity and a link into the Kantar business as clients can build compelling pictures of shopper behavior from the core panel and then ask direct questions to panelists who have bought their product, ask them why they bought it and what they thought about it. They can only do this because of the size of the panel, which is over 100,000 in size, and it's growing, and because their coverage covers every single retail channel. And this scale opens up more opportunities to use data. The app to collect the data is fun and easy to use, which drives continued data supply. And in the round, it's very much a technology-led business. On the other side of the business, the ad intel business captures creative and ad spend data for agencies and brands, and Promo does something similar to circulars and promotions, and is part of very similar to what we've got already in existing parts of the business, as you can see on the slide. And not only does the panel business fit neatly in the world panel, we've got crossovers into our media businesses and our consulting businesses as well. If we move on, Numerator, as I said, has a very strong client base. It's diverse, it's scaled, but from the work we've done, we know we can gain share from the current base. And let's not forget that most of these clients are already existing Kantar clients who, historically, we've not been able to support or work with in the US. So this combination with WorldPanel and Numerator would give clients a coherent global view of what's happening to their products. This better client offer delivered globally should unlock real revenue synergies, which we've not baked into any of our plans. Numerator, in our view, is differentiated through its scale, in terms of the panel size, its technology, the breadth and depth of its data, which takes years to build, its easy-to-use platforms where it collects data, and the speed at which it takes that data and delivers it back to its clients, and the comprehensive coverage across all channels. We also know, when we look at this business, there's a significant unserved opportunity, in particular in North America, in the small and medium-sized market, which should ideally be served by a user-friendly platform, very similar to what the Numerator business has built. So we're very excited about the starting phase for this business. And as we move on, So our vision is to create a global leader in consumer panels by combining Kantar, Worldpanel and Numerator. The combination of the Asturian Numerator business with the currency that is essentially what Worldpanel is in its existing markets is really exciting. We can use common technology across both businesses. We can offer a true global experience or a tailored local offer. We can share specialist skills in analytics and data science and unlock cost synergies and shared ways of working for both the panel business and the Ad-Intel or PAP businesses. If we deliver that, we will see accelerated growth and strong cash flows. And on the final slide, which is just a little more colour and what makes this so exciting, and at the bottom of the slide, we call out $33 million of cost synergies, which are mainly on the PAP side of the business, which we believe we can unlock. But the growth is going to come from harnessing the best of both panel businesses. Because if you get this right, we can create that global panel business driven by great talent and technology. You know, Kantar's got strong C-suite relationships with key clients and is the respected brand in the market. Numerator is arguably the disruptor. Numerator has that great app technology. Kantar's got great data science in a center of excellence based in Portugal. And by bringing in a strong, dedicated, passionate team from Numerator, it increases our scale and management bandwidth to push into new revenue streams, increase coverage, increase new ways of working, open up new markets, and therefore, it's genuinely an exciting combination. If we now move on, we'll just go into the Kantar business and explain what's been going on there in the first quarter of the year. And these are the headlines, and I'll try not to repeat too much as we go through this, but our revenues are just under $900 million in Q1, are up 3% on last year. But it's important for everyone to know we're not just chasing revenue. That's hardly been Kantar's problem in the past. We need to make sure we're doing profitable work. So we're very focused on price, on delivery, and working with our clients, which is behind some of the areas we're investing in to drive better products, more automation, and a better revenue mix, which is starting to come through in our improved gross margin. A better product mix, tight cost control, and we get to $180 million of EBITDA and a 5% EBITDA margin improvement, which is even after significant investment in reward and variable pay linked to the performance of the business, which we'll come back to later. So this good trading, strong working capital management, and we can fund investment in improved systems and processes to drive further efficiencies. But we can also invest in our products for the future of the business, which is why our CapEx is increasing slightly in the first quarter. Can we move on? This slide has two things. First, it shows continued improvement in our revenue trends from the low of Q2 2020 to the growth we just discussed, including the 18% growth in April. But it also shows that the actions we've taken to protect profits and cash, initially through temporary measures in Q2 and Q3 of last year, and now through more structural savings, which we executed in Q4 last year, are starting to benefit 2021. And are making the business a more efficient business, which should have improving margins. And we should see a good rate of conversion of revenue to EBITDA, especially across Q2 and Q3 of this year, if our current booking momentum continues. Maintaining our profitability through the past 12 months in the face of some significant short-term revenue decline, we think is an achievement we should be proud of. So we move on. This is the revenue waterfall by division, and you can see that the standout of Worldpanel at 11% and Public at 34%. The Public performance is mainly in the UK, and driven by work we've done around COVID testing, work which we expect to continue for at least another year. Worldpanel's growth is across all markets. We've seen strong growth in the UK, in France in particular, and Brazil, and shows the strong global demand for shopper behaviour insights that businesses like Worldpanel and Numerator both deliver. Insights is our biggest division, and whilst revenues are flat in total, in part, this is because we've walked away from some lower margin work, which has helped our gross margin, but also because the US, our biggest market, had a strong comparative after a good start last year. In Insights, we've seen the UK, China and India all deliver double-digit growth in Q1. Our analytics and creative practices are strong, and our brand revenues in total were up 6% to the end of Q1, which is very encouraging as this is the largest part of our insights business. The media division is down 3% in the quarter. Our audience measurement business within this, because of its secured contracts, is broadly flat. The declines are coming from other parts of the portfolio. The next slide just shows the revenue breakdown by geography. And in summary, what we're seeing is a really strong performance in the UK, helped by Public and Willpower, as we discussed, but all businesses in the UK are growing strongly. APAC was boosted in particular by China and India, which is an amazing performance by India, given the horrific wave of COVID that they've been living through. And LATAM, because it's mainly a world panel and audience measurement, i.e. long-term contract or secure contract market, has performed broadly as we've expected. Europe, in general, has been pretty flat. If we move on to the final slide in this section for me, which is a summary P&L which calls it all together, it's nice seeing 3% revenue growth, which is better than we expected. It's also good to see how that revenue upside flows through to EBITDA and showing the benefit of all the work we've done previously on costs and starting to make a real difference both in terms of absolute profit and the margin improvement we've got. So a $44 million EBITDA improvement and a near 5% margin improvement is a pleasing start to the year. You can see the cost savings against SG&A and staff costs totaling $17 million. This is over $50 million if we add back the variable pay accruals we've made for incentives to drive business performance. The $35 million of incentives we've accrued in Q1 should not be extrapolated. Firstly, it's roughly half of what we expect to pay on a full year basis, not a quarter. And secondly, the balance of the prior year was nil, so there's no comparative, as all schemes at this time last year were underwater because of our outlook in the COVID environment. Over the full year, any additional costs will be driven by growth and outperforming our targets. And based on our latest forecast, the total increase year on year in terms of these variable pay costs is likely to be around $40 million. So arguably, we've taken a hit for all of that in the first quarter. I'll now hand you over to Peter to take you through the balance sheet, working capital and cash flows.
Thank you, Ian. So I'm now on slide 21. At 31st of March, net working capital was negative $180 million, a year-on-year improvement of $164 million before the benefits of factoring and a $228 million improvement when factoring is included. So breaking down and starting from the left after the slide, net working capital at the end of March 2020 was positive $48 million. We've realized an improvement year-on-year of $44 million in debtors, excluding the impact of factoring, due to the improved collection processes instigated last year, which Ian has already mentioned, and these have also resulted in a $63 million reduction in overdue debtors. Next, food revenue continues to reduce, and with the lapping of our improved payment processes and policies, we've realized a year-on-year improvement in trade creditors of $68 million. And as we continue to improve our billing procedures, we've seen a $34 million improvement in deferred income. And finally, the incremental improvement of $64 million in the factoring benefit reflects the fact that at March 2020, we were in the process of rolling out the program, which is now fully embedded. Moving on to our net debt and EBITDA. Firstly, in terms of our pro forma adjusted EBITDA of $680 million at 31st of March, this includes $170 million of run rate savings, which Ian has already mentioned and we'll discuss in a little bit more detail in a couple of slides time. Moving on to our leverage, our pro forma senior secured net debt and a multiple of pro forma adjusted EBITDA was 3.2 times at March, improvement from Q4 2020, where it was 3.5 times. And turning to our cash, the balance at March of $516 million reflects the cash within the lender's perimeter. During the quarter, we repaid a further $88 million of the revolver, leaving a drawn balance of $72 million at quarter end, which I'm pleased to say was fully repaid during April. Total liquidity at the end of March was over $920 million, including undrawn committed facilities, more of which we discussed on the next slide. Moving on to the liquidity waterfall, I'll now describe the key drivers of the pro forma cash and liquidity in the quarter. So starting again at the left, we benefited from a working capital inflow of over $40 million in the quarter, plus a positive EBITDA contribution to cash flow of over $120 million. Out of these inflows, we serviced debt interest, leases, tax, and capital expenditures totaling nearly $80 million. We've also paid restructuring and transformation costs of around $50 million and acquisition and disposal related costs of around $20 million. And finally, as I mentioned, we repaid $88 million of the revolver, leaving a closing cash balance of $516 million. The closing cash balance is before the health proceeds received after quarter end. And after adding on the undrawn committed facilities, our total pro forma liquidity is over $120 million. I will now pass back to Ian, who will provide a trading update.
Thanks, Peter. As I said before, the confidence of the global economy is a little fragile, but we have seen a return to our clients spending money with us. Wanting to understand behavior of their clients and their customers, how their brand is perceived, how effective their advertising is. That's what we do, and we're getting better and better at delivering. I reported last time we had our strongest ever client satisfaction scores in 2020, and we're seeing the benefits of that in our 2021 trading. Our top 25 customers are growing 8% in Q1, which reflects the strength of our relationships with them, and also money is returning to their budgets. All of our measures of forward revenue visibility have been set up positive, trending nicely ahead of historic averages, as we've discussed. The most useful measure, I think, is having two-thirds of our target revenue secured in the order book, which is 3% ahead of normal. And even though the revenue outlook is positive at April 18%, we're still staying relentlessly focused on costs and cash. On the cost side, as we said before, we expect the permanent actions we've taken to more than offset the benefits we realised in 2020 when we had to respond quickly to the revenue impact of COVID. Today, we've identified $320 million of savings across our business. Some will take time to realise, some have already been realised. You just flick on, Peter. Hopefully this will help a little bit. The chart on the left, our 2021 results, will include cumulative savings of $235 million. And we think there's a further around $85 million more we can deliver on top of that. This is over $100 million ahead of the original Bond OM. These savings are coming from reducing spare capacity, getting the right bands and layers, simplifying the business, automation, offshoring, and driving continuous process improvements, in particular through the back office, as well as increased involvement from our procurement team. For EBITDA and LTM purposes, we've got $170 million run rate savings with firm plans, which we are or we will deliver and get the benefits of in future periods. This will see us invest more in one-off and severance, but the return is strong, and we're seeing that in the Q1 results. Just click on. On the liquidity side, as Peter said, we've got a healthy position, good trading and discipline around working capital. This gives us the confidence to invest in the business, organically and inorganically, driving change and new products, which will create a stronger business and one that from next year should be highly cash generative. By the end of this year, we will be largely through the investment and change period, so the level of one-offs will reduce and CapEx returns to our normal levels, which will really strengthen our cash flow. So we move on, Peter. We're just going to quickly just take you through new rates of trading, which as you'll see is incredibly strong and well ahead of their plan. Their bookings were up over 80% in the first quarter. Their annual recurring revenue, which is their subs revenue, is up over 24% revenue. Their panel revenues, which as we've talked is closely aligned to our world panel business, are up over 50%, and we've seen very strong EBITDA growth. On the panel side of the business is securing continued conversion of increased revenue from existing clients. We're converting to being the primary panel provider with more of those clients, and we're seeing strong sales from non-CPG accounts. Importantly, this momentum is continuing into April. And as you can see, this momentum is also converting nicely into EBITDA, which when you look at their Q1 performance and look at it on a billings basis, i.e. the revenue they've got secured by contracts, it's up over 70%. Peter, over to you on financing.
Thank you, Ian. So, slide 29, sources and uses and pro forma capitalization for the Numerator acquisition. Just really note the key points on the slide are that in terms of funding the acquisition, our shareholders are contributing $350 million and the company is also utilizing $150 million of cash from the balance sheet, which predominantly will come from the health disposal proceeds. So moving on to slide 30, which shows the combined last 12 months pro forma EBITDA for both Kantar and Numerator, and there's quite a few numbers and adjustments on this, which I'll run through. So starting with our reported last 12 months EBITDA of $499 million, which are in the financial statements, this excludes earnings from associates. So we add back on the cash dividends received from associates of $10 million. And then the reported run rate savings already discussed of $171 million. If we then take off the health division annual EBITDA, we get Kantar's standalone pro forma adjusted EBITDA of $655 million. Next, taking Numerator's last 12 months EBITDA of $49 million, we add on $22 million relating to the annual value of recurring new contracts, for which they've been paid in advance, and then deduct $3 million relating to the cost to serve for these new contracts. The cost reduction initiatives of $6 million are already been executed by the Numerator team, and the IFRS impact of $4 million reflects the same treatment as IFRS 16 in line with Kantar. The other transaction adjustments of $7 million relates to some buy-side adjustments to reflect the temporary COVID measures in place in 2020, which are expected to unwind. And finally, we add in the synergies of $33 million that reflects the benefits across operations, technology, and marketing that Ian has already discussed that will be realized post-completion to arrive at $760 million of pro forma adjusted EBITDA for the combined group. I'll now hand back to Ian, who will sum up.
Yeah, thanks, Peter, and thank you, everyone, on the call for your patience. We've covered a lot of ground, but hopefully you get a sense of our confidence in the strong start we've made and delivered at Kantar, and we expect to deliver that and continue to deliver that across Q2. Plus also the excitement we've got at the potential built on a really impressive high-growth panel business that Numerator brings to the Kantar group. So thank you for your time, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. So to ask any question, please key star then one on your telephone. If you then decide to withdraw your question, you can remove it by simply keying star then two. And as a further reminder to ask a question, you key star then one on your telephone. And we do have some questions coming through. The first question, it comes from the line of Ryan Bacabro-Dingley. Please go ahead, Ryan.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for the call and congratulations on the recent performance. Just a couple quick questions from my side. In terms of Numerator, can you confirm how many full-time employees they currently have roughly, and then how many of those are going to be made redundant and maybe the cash out for that? I'm just trying to understand how much of the $33 million and the $6 million synergies are coming from that.
Numerator has roughly 2,000 employees. I'm not going to give you a number of what in terms of headcount reductions are going to make, because actually there's some interesting opportunities when we look across the combination of the businesses, so it would be wrong to say they're all going to come from Numerator. the cash cost of delivering the $33 million of efficiencies and synergies are $25 million, if that helps. But I don't think it's right to call out a specific headcount saving number at this stage.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Thank you. And then cash on balance sheet, I think pro forma for March still have quite a bit of cash. What's the level of cash you might expect to have in a more normalized environment given that performance has been strong and we're sort of coming out of a COVID world? Is there a rough target that management thinks is appropriate?
Yeah, I'll take that. So somewhere around the $300 million mark is probably the right level. And part of that is driven by the fact we are, you know, we are a global business. We've got lots of legal entities with lots of bank accounts. And so we've all at any one time a lot of cash in the system. That being said, we're making a lot of good progress to bring a lot of that cash back to the center. We need approaching $200 million of cash back to the center from the various regions year to date. So that's just this year. Obviously, we need to keep that going. As the business throws off cash, we'll keep recycling back to the centre via dividends and loans. But we inherited, you know, quite a messy sort of banking infrastructure, and we're working on that at the moment to clean it up and to improve the pooling, etc. But we made fantastic progress, and that will carry on.
That's very helpful. Thank you. And then last one for me. I think there were some changes in senior management not too long ago. I don't know if there is any update on that process that you can get lenders.
No, I think yeah, we'll spend the right level of time to get the right person into the role. It's unfortunate it didn't work out last time, but I think we demonstrated across 2020 that even without a CEO in charge, yeah, there's a strong leadership team here. At the moment, I'm sort of holding the fort like I did last year, and I think we showed that we can get a lot of stuff done and continue to progress against the plans we've got. So I've no worries about us continuing to build on this momentum in the short term.
Yeah, okay, great. That's it from my side. It seems like you already have the management team you need in place. So good luck. That's it for me.
Thank you.
Thank you. And the next question comes from the line of Hugo Obisella. Please go ahead, Hugo.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my question. I have few, if I may. The first one is on working capital changes. In Q1, we saw a working capital inflow. Can you please give us a guidance for the full year 21? For the working capital, if so or also?
Yes, I'll take that. So overall for 2021, we're looking at probably a relatively flat to slightly positive working capital movement. So as you can imagine, there are some, you know, there was some lumpiness to it over the period, but overall, our sort of cautious outlook is it's a slightly positive for the year.
Okay, and do you think that this inflow will more than compensate the restructuring costs?
So it's obviously a combination of the improvements we made on work capital and also, you know, dealing with our liquidity, which I discussed in the previous answer. So we do have a lot of cash. We are recycling that, and then also the underlying business is cash generative. And as you can see from our excellent results so far, you know, we're really recovering well, and that is flowing off cash. So it's a mixture of the cash generation of the business, the working capital will keep that level at least, as well as you know, recycling all the liquidity we have around the group will fund those costs.
Sorry, you go. Can I just add two things? Whilst the working capital may be slightly positive this year, there's still a lot of improvements we can make, both in terms of our billing processes and the collection of our cash, in particular the aged debt. So we're the opportunity to make a difference on working capital, I think, is still very real and very significant. So that's something for us to go at, which is good. And hopefully you picked it up in my narrative earlier. This restructuring costs this year are high, but we do expect them to significantly reduce in future, and that will make a big difference to the net cash generated by the business. We expect to be very cash positive going forward, because as Peter says, the underlying business is very cash positive.
Okay, so overall, working capital inflow expected for the year, or break even, right? Yeah, okay. But no precise guidance from your boss, you get just a range of how do you think or you expect that the working capital will stand at the end of the year?
Well, as Ian said, there is more to go after. Obviously when we model this, we are cautious, prudent. At the moment, in terms of our modelling, it's sort of flat to sort of positive in the sort of low single digit to teens level, but of course there is more to get, and so we model it on that basis, so holding steady with all the gains we've got, but we'll go after more.
I just have one more thing. This is the first year ever in Kantar's history that the senior management team have working capital as a target for them to shoot for. They've never had that discipline before, they've never had that focus before. So, we're culturally changing the organisation to be much more cash aware and disciplined in managing working capital. So even though we are growing nicely and there's a lot of focus on product and the new development and margin mix, we are staying very focused on running a good business, and I think focus on cash and working capital is a key part of that.
Okay, great. And just a quick follow-up question on the factoring program. How large is it right now, and maybe can you give us an amount of factoring used, and if it's with or without recourse?
So the factoring program is non-recourse. The facility size is 160 million euro, and that is around about 90% utilised at the moment. And we have that program rolled out across six countries.
Okay, great. Just one more question on the acquisition. I saw that the pro forma leverage is pretty contained. What is the maximum leverage that do you accept and is going forward, and when do you see maybe your leverage to peak? Including this acquisition.
So, in terms of leverage, obviously this is a fantastic opportunity in terms of the acquisition. As we discussed, the business is already throwing off cash, so we expect leverage to decrease as EBITDA grows and as we generate cash. We don't have any specific targets, but obviously we want to get this deal done, and then the focus is on generating EBITDA and managing the working capital, the cash, etc., going forward, and that will then actually lead to a reduction in leverage.
Okay, so you don't see any risk of being downgraded following the acquisition?
We're obviously going through that process at the moment, so I can't comment on that at the moment.
Okay. Maybe one last question, if I may, on the EBITDA. There is a lot of adjustment between the personal EBITDA figure and the reported one, especially linked to the restructuring. Maybe if you have a guidance or figure to give us on how many effects are planned for 2021. If I'm not wrong, last year was about 300 million. Do you have something to give us for the effects that are planned for 2021?
Yeah, it is on the slide. It's $185 million is what we expect the one-off to be, which is a mixture of severance and project costs, excluding any M&A stuff.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Okay. Cheers. Thanks.
Thank you. And the next question comes from the line of Matthew Vestanius. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you for the presentation. I have a few questions. The first one is on the synergies. What percentage of synergies are cost and versus revenue?
I'm not on that ratio, to be frank. But as I say, it's $33 million of synergies. It's mainly across the PAS side of the business, the ad intel side of the business, where we see real opportunities to have, because we've got similar business in North America, so running it using common technology, common supply data, common way of working, one team should unlock real value. There are some potential synergies on the panel side. As we talked about in the release, we've got Kantar already, a great data science team. They've got better e-commerce or email solutions, so there's some technology sharing we can do which will drive savings. And then when you're looking at a business like this, there's clearly in time back office savings that can do a lot. So we're confident on these $33 million of savings. And as I mentioned, we've not got any revenue synergies in, which I think in time we will see, because we've got a good overlap of clients in terms of Kantar, primarily wall panels, but also with insights, reaching clients globally that we don't serve as well in North America, which Numerate will allow us to offer something differently. Their survey business could be something we use more generally across North America. So there's some really interesting opportunities there. I haven't got the initial the revenue percentage, but these are pretty firm numbers in terms of thought through delivery and plans behind them. Or as firm as they can be into the early business and really getting to kind of it.
Okay. So from what I understand from what you said, is mainly costs, right?
Well, these are all costs. Yeah.
Okay.
$3 million
Okay. Thank you. And the $20 million of cost to achieve that you mentioned earlier, this comes on top of the 185, or it's already included in the 185?
It's on top of the 185.
Okay. Thank you. I had a question on the equity coming as part of the transaction. Is that coming all from Bain, or part is coming from the WPP? Or?
No, it's coming from Bain and WPP in proportion to the 60-40 split that they invested in Kantar.
Okay. And then a question on current trading. Do you see, and since you mentioned April, I think you can comment a little bit on that. Did you see any slowdown in India in April compared to the first quarter overall? And if you can give us some color on maybe May, that would be great.
I'm not going to go into May in too much detail, but the outlook into May, against what we're tracking to, is looking very positive, and that's why, when I was going through, I'm very confident we'll deliver double-digit revenue growth across the second quarter. And our bookings into May are ahead of where they need to be to deliver our target. And the next 90 days, bookings are ahead of where they need to be to deliver their target. And the full year is ahead. So I think every single metric we use to track our order book is indicating that we will beat our current forecast for the year. India traded well in April. It was up 24%, which just shows it continued to deliver. It's interesting though, but we get the teams are delivering revenue, and we recognise revenue when we deliver it. So we saw a slight slowdown in orders in the month for future months, and we saw our field teams who actually have to go out and do face-to-face interviews. Clearly, that was a problem for those teams. Both teams are operating at around 65-70% capacity, but that only lasted for a couple of weeks. And the field teams are now back up to about 80-85% capacity. The office teams, the insights teams, are working at over 90% capacity. So India has come back really quickly. It has real momentum, as I said, at the start of the year. And it looks like the confidence in the Indian economy is high, and the second wave, from our point of view, there's no sign that has knocked that confidence. Yeah, and the team have got through it amazingly resiliently, even though it's a horrific experience.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments and answering these questions.
No problem.
Thank you. And we do have about 5 more questions at this time. And the next question comes in line of Mary Pollock. Please go ahead, Mary.
Hi. Thanks for taking the question.
Mary, you're very faint.
Sorry.
Okay. Yeah.
All right, thanks. So the first question is on the Numerator deal and the Mimo Square, sorry if I mispronounced that, announced this morning. Are there any earnouts related to either deal, and about what kind of size should we think about those, and when would they come due if that's the case?
The Numerator deal doesn't have an earnout on it, as you'd expect. Management team is incentivized, but it doesn't have an earnout on it. Memo Square is a very small deal. The initial consideration is, so low we're not even talking about it. It's less than 10 million. Mm-hmm. There is an earnout on it, but again, this is a very small business. What we're buying there is essentially a team and a capability that fills in an advertising campaign effectiveness skill gap that we don't, and capability we don't have in our EMEA business. If we can leverage, they're currently based in Holland, if we can leverage it across the region, we can really accelerate the growth. So it could be quite a neat little acquisition for us. So it is a small business.
Great, thanks. And I want to dig in a little bit maybe on insights. Congrats on the Barb renewal. That is good news, even though it's probably been for a while. You talk a lot about the secured revenues, the 67%. How much of the revenues that aren't secured are from insights? And as a follow-up, how can we think about the growth outlook for that piece? I don't think we have much insight into the rest of the year on. If you could give us any feel for, growth in 2021 or long-term CAGR, what you're thinking about, that would be super helpful.
Yeah, I think this, it would be dangerous to give you targets. Not only because we're working through with the team where we want to really invest in the insights business, because it's a very, as we were talking through, it's a broad business. I'm not sure we can win in every part of the business. And when I look at today's performance, which I think is interesting, if I look at the brand business, which is the area that people say, well, I'm not sure about brand. Yeah, at the end of April, our brand business was up 10%. Our creative business is up 16%. Our innovation business is up 16%. Our analytics business, business is up nearly 20%. But our customer experience business is having a tough time and is down. But part of the reason it's down is because we walked away from some unprofitable contracts. And that's one of the things we've done across Insights is do a root and branch review of every single job we do across the whole business. We've graded every single job red, grey and green by their margins, and we've set the team targets to change the shape of the portfolio so we have more green, which is obviously positive, and less red, in terms of the portfolio mix over time. So Yeah, we're doing a lot of work to get this team much more, and get the business much more commercial and much more focused. So, yeah, the domains are generally in pretty good shape. There's a large bit of the Insight business which is called Other, which comes back to the history of Kantar being lots of disparate things all put together, and you know, one of our jobs for the rest of this year is to work through the Other bucket, because this is stuff that doesn't neatly fit into the brand or create or innovation, and make sure we've got a clear plan for it. If I look at the bookings for Insight, we are 7% ahead of where we would need to be for May, which is great. We're 3% ahead of our target for the 90-day revenue, and we are 2% ahead for the full year. So we've got over 60% of our full year target revenue booked for Insight. And that's about 2% ahead of where we need to be this time of year, if that helps.
Yeah.
So our bookings on Insight are good.
Okay. Thanks. That's very, very helpful.
I think there's one thing which we should work through to help everybody is the danger that everybody sees Insight as a custom business. In fact, a lot of our clients come back to us on a regular basis because we've done the work for them in a consistent way with consistent data, with a consistent methodology for many years. So even though sort of the work has to get renewed every year, it's very difficult for a lot of this work, especially on the brand side, to move from one to another because the cost of change or the impact of change for some of these brand owners is quite significant. So I think we need to do a little bit more work explaining actually how much of our revenues are reoccurring in that sense. Because they're not subscriptions, but actually they're much more secure than I think the word custom would suggest that they are.
Yeah, that makes sense. They're sticky.
They are sticky, yeah.
Thanks. And just a last one, if that's okay. Again, on the numerator EBITDA, can you just explain the difference between the adjusted numerator EBITDA of $49 million and the numerator billing basis EBITDA of $71? Those are just pretty big differences, and I'm not familiar enough with the business to know, you know, why we should be increasing it by that delta.
Because the numerator business, which is something we should think about for a world panel, They're selling essentially subscriptions, and the best way of getting a sense of the health of the business is to look at what, and they call it billings, is what's in their order book for, what they've got signed up and contracted on a billings basis. So on a 12-month basis, they're saying, If you take what they have signed, what they've got contracted, and run that through and add a level of cost against delivery, against it, which Peter talked through, the earnings for the year on a 12-month LTM basis would be $71 million. In the first quarter, which is up, so that $71 million is up 40% against the similar calculation for last year. But in the first quarter on the same basis, up 73%. So the rate of growth on a billing basis is really accelerating because we're getting more people coming through on a renewing subscription, which is what it's all about. Does that help? It's more of a cash basis than it is anything else.
Okay, so that cash is booked essentially with the billing? I mean, that's...
Yeah, they bill up front in advance. And we get paid for it.
Okay.
Good working capital.
Okay, thank you. And the next question comes from the line of Alec Ishia. Please go ahead, Alec.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my questions. Perhaps if I could just start off with a clarificatory or a couple clarificatory questions. So on slide 17, when you show your revenue progression, would it be possible just to understand perhaps For the month of April, what April 2000 was versus 2019, or alternatively, what April 21 is versus 2019, just to get an idea of how much it's bounced back versus the fall.
April 2021 against 2019 is down a couple of percent.
Okay.
Just the month of April. So
yeah.
It was up 18% against 2020 and down a couple of percent against 2019.
Okay, that's helpful. And if I could just ask, the call-out box is positioned next to the LTM EBITDA number, and you have a comment saying further $30 million increase in April only. Could you just clarify what that comment means there, please?
Oops. I haven't got the slide in front of me. Hey, do you got that? I've lost the slide.
So, Ian, do you want me to go back to it? On the... Go back. Can you do that?
Oh, it's the LTM calculation of the, it's the 499, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, so you're basically saying that the 499 has come back $30 million in April, or?
We did the same calculation from April to April, it would be 529.
Okay, it's 529, got it. So basically, April added $30 million of EBITDA.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, that's helpful.
Incrementally EBITDA.
Yeah, $30 million incrementally, yeah. Okay, so on that point, it just kind of flipping to slide 20, and apologies if I haven't understood your slides correctly, but slide 20 basically shows that you have saved about $17 million, I think it is, in terms of STAPCOM and other G&A for Q1. So I'm just wondering if you could perhaps give us a sense of the phasing of the $235 million that you expect for 2021 in terms of when we can start to expect to see the bulk of that kind of start flowing through?
Well, if you ignore the fact we've added $35 million in incentive costs into this first quarter, the run rate of savings would be over $50 million. So $50 million a quarter, you quickly get close to $235 million. We're going to be delivering at that sort of rate. It's pretty even across the rest of the year, actually. It will gradually increase in Q3 and Q4, but we're starting to see the savings coming through already.
Okay. So is that the $35 million of incentive cost part of the 185?
No. The $35 million is embedded in our EBITDA number. The $185 is excluded from our EBITDA number. If we hadn't booked the incentive costs, which, as I said, are against a comparator of no cost last year, we would have been $35 million higher EBITDA. We could have booked an EBITDA number of $153.
But I mean, you would have to pay out those $35 million of incentive costs, right?
Arguably, we over accrued in the first quarter.
Okay. Okay. So should we see some of that reverse out throughout the rest of the year?
Well, maybe I didn't make myself clear. That the full year costs, when you look at the variable costs and incentive costs on a full year basis, the increment year on year, which will be driven by the fact that we've got schemes which are paying out and are performing, and the team are performing, business is performing, will be around, based on our latest forecast, will be around $40 million more over the full year. We've arguably taken a hit for that in the first quarter. Because what happened last year, all the schemes that we had in place at the end of Q1 were dead. They were all completely blown out by COVID. So when we looked ahead, we didn't accrue anything because we didn't expect to pay anything. And then our board agreed, quite rightly, that we should incentivize the teams to actually deliver, whether it's delivering cost targets or delivering the profit target we have. And we did pay bonuses last year based on the teams delivering. So over the COVID phasing thing here, that we booked costs in the first quarter, we didn't have any last year, and it'll gradually even itself out across the year. But we will definitely pay more this year because the business performance is better.
Understood. Okay. And then just staying on that slide again, 25. So up to $50 million pro forma cost savings, which we just kind of discussed, how much of those are those all permanent, or is part of that kind of is some of that from COVID-related temporary savings?
No, the 235 is all permanent structural costs taken out of the business for good.
Okay.
And, yeah, the temporary savings that were COVID-related, things like pay cuts and reduced hours, are all sort of reversing through. So these savings we are making this year, which we started to execute back end of last year and been executing Q1 this year, will more than offset the temporary savings we delivered last year.
Understood. Okay. And then just if I may, two more questions. Just looking to page 29, I guess the first question is, this senior secured new debt, this is going to be carried with your existing bank debt and bonds, if I understood it correctly?
Yes. Yeah.
And is that already in place, or do you need to go to the market and raise this?
No, we need to go to the market.
Okay. And then can I understand the leverage number here you're using 4x through your secured net debt? I guess that the senior notes, these are basically based on IFRS 16 EBITDA, but they're not including the operating leases in your net leverage number, right? That, if I've understood it correctly?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. And finally, could you just help me understand because I see that your covenant LTM EBITDA is 661 here. What is that pro forma EBITDA to allow you to raise the $900 million? Are you raising the $900 million off of the 661, or do you have to do further adjustments in order to be able to get to $900 million under your basket?
I don't think there's any other adjustments required. You're referring to the covenant leverage, is that right?
Yes, that's right. So basically, you're raising this other $900 million within your permitted debt baskets, assuming on a leverage, total leverage or net leverage basis. So I was just wondering if I did the calculation, would I need to make any further adjustments to get to $900 million?
Not really. Really, it's off the sort of the underlying EBITDA 499 plus. Obviously, we look at the run rate savings and we look at the models, and there's some adjustments for small adjustments for associates. But otherwise, there's nothing else.
Okay, understood. All right, it's very helpful. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. We do have three more questions at this time. The next question is from the line of Chris Money. Please go ahead, Chris.
Hi, guys. Most of them might have been asked, but a few random ones. Just on the agency discussions, obviously they changed the outlooks on the ratings. I just wondered whether that included all of the information around shareholder investment and synergies.
So in terms of the outlook that was changed sort of a while ago, obviously that reflected the current position, which that was several months ago.
Yeah, I just wanted to confirm that. Are you hopeful of trying to retain some of those mid B ratings on?
I can't comment at the moment. What's going on?
Okay. Okay, cool. And then you've done a fair few deals recently, selling, buying. I just wondered whether you have anything else planned or whether you're hitting the pause button for a while.
I've got nothing material planned at the moment.
Okay. Okay, great. Just a follow-up on the new bond. I just wonder whether you had any sort of indication on timing when you might look to do that.
Well, obviously, in terms of the debt, which is fully underwritten, that will be raised and closed concurrent with the the closing of the acquisition of Numerator. So we're going through obviously both processes at the moment.
Okay, great. And then a bit of a random one, just given the recent news flow on Nilton and their issues with viewership recording in the US, I just wanted to throw the question to you to see whether you'd had any similar type issues with household collection on viewership data, whether you think there's any risk there, and how your OTC product that you've obviously been launching recently is, how that's been going.
We're very pleased with our new meters. We've just won the Dutch tender, which is great, and as someone mentioned earlier, the fact we've renewed BART with new technology I think is really encouraging, and I think it shows very strongly an endorsement of both the team and the technology we use. We've had it was tough through COVID in terms of measurement because the old meters that were being used in some markets do break, and you do need to go and fix them, and that can be quite hard if you're locked out. But we generally met our SLAs, or the buyers of our data were generally supportive and understood. The key with these things is talking to your clients and building and making sure you've got a good relationship. And I think we've done a good job through all that, and there's no issues that I'm aware of that have been flagged at all. The fact that we just had two big wins, I think, is really reassuring.
Okay, great. That's all from me. Everything has been asked before. Thanks.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. And the next question comes from the line of Vivek Khanna. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Sorry, I apologize, I was on mute. I had two questions, if I may, largely linked to capital structure. So the first question is, with regards to the incremental 900 million euros of debt in conjunction with the Numerator acquisition, I just wanted to confirm, is that going to be in loan form, or is that still to be determined whether you do loans or bonds? I guess that's my first question. And then the second question is, again, this is a follow-up from a question that was asked by an investor just previously on the call. You present pro forma leverage here at 4.5 times through the sub-notes and 3.9 through the senior secure tranches. But again, that is excluding the lease liability, which if you go to slide 22, where you look at when you present net debt on a standalone basis, you do include it. So I'm just sort of wondering, what's the rationale of presenting it separately, or is it something to do with maybe how your covenants or your debt ratios are calculated? Just trying to get some color on that would be great.
So, once the first question, we are looking at both markets, obviously working that through with our banks, and then in terms of leverage, the IFRS 16 adjustment, when they look at it, but it's obviously debt-like, but we're looking at here and focusing on the senior secured and the secured debt leverage, which works for the investor market. We're all aware of the IFRS adjustment. The rating agencies always made those adjustments, but this is just a way of looking at it, which is very standard market convention.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And the last question comes from the line of Naveed Mokhtar. Please go ahead.
Hi guys, thanks for the presentation. Just a couple of questions on Numerator for me. Firstly, can you just maybe explain a little bit to me about the key differential of the Numerator business compared to its peers in the U.S., like Nielsen and the other competitive IRI? How does the business differ, and where do you see the real value in this business? So I'm trying to understand the multiple paid for this business? And secondly, just in terms of the billing EBITDA, that looks like the EBITDA that you guys are using for your pro forma calculation. Is that treatment in line with the Kantar EBITDA that you use? Or I'm just trying to understand if this is just an accounting difference between the cash flow EBITDA and the P&L EBITDA, or whether there's any, and if that's consistent with how you guys report it on Kantar?
We don't treat our subs that way because we haven't got the, I mean, for us it wouldn't make that much of a difference, not least of which we haven't got the growth rates that the numerator business is delivering. It is an interesting way of disclosing it, but it's for a business of this size where there's a material difference between billing, cash flow and the P&L, as in when the revenue gets recognised, it gives a more accurate view of the cash flows of the business, which I think is important. So it is a sensible measure for the purposes of looking at how the business is performing. Just in terms of the differential between Numerator and, you know, the two competitors in the market are IRI and Nielsen, who were arguably the incumbents, who were very focused on point of sale data rather than the panel side of things. And what Numerator have done over the last few years, and these things do take time because you have to build a panel scale, which they've done, and it's 3 times bigger than the equivalent IRI Nielsen panel. They collect more data, they make that data available quicker, it's cheaper, and yeah, it's a single source of data, a single panel of data covering all retail channels. So it's an omni-channel coverage, which the other ones do not cover. So yeah, it's bigger, quicker, and got better data, if you wanted a summary of it. So as a product, that makes a massive difference. And then when you look at then how it collects the data, you know, the Receipt Hog app, which is on the mobile phone, which scans the data, it's very efficient and actually it's fun for the users. So that's the differentiator. And then the platform, which is then delivered almost as a software as a service type app, you know, platform to the clients, it is a great way of delivering their data to them. So they've got access to that data quickly, it's there, it's on the screen, and we can upsell more functionality, more tools, more value added to that. And that's why when we did, you know, a lot of diligence around the business and how it's seen in the market, you know, their NPS scores are really high, their ratings on data high, rating on channel coverage high, rate speed is high, ease of use, high price, very high, customer service, very high. And on every single one of those measures, it was ahead of IRI or Nielsen. And then, as I said, you know, the NPS scores are really, really high, and their propensity to switch, where we asked customers, you know, would they move from their current supplier to Numerator, the propensity to switch scores are very high as well. So, yeah, they're the key things that really make this business stand out, and I think, you know, give it this window of opportunity to really build on the fantastic position they've created, which would take several years for anyone else to catch up on, both in terms of technology and size of talent, and I think that's really exciting.
Thank you for that. And in terms of the way you describe it, it sounds very similar to how your World Panel business operates as well, so it seems to be kind of synergies in operations of those two. So in terms of the purchase of Numerator and especially the multiple and the price that you're paying, is it really just to get a strong foothold in the North American market, which you might lack with your current World Panel business?
Oh, it would be very hard for us to build a business of scale in North America organically. In fact, it would be almost impossible. And it would take years to do that, and you're going against not just Numerator but IRI and Nielsen as well. So
we think having a footprint in North America, the biggest market, is the one thing that's missing from Worldpanel, which is a fantastic business in 45 markets, growing double digit, but it hasn't got a foothold in North America. And our proposition to our clients, being a global business, is now really, will be really enhanced by having Numeris as part of the Canpar portfolio.
Thank you. And just finally, one more thing. Just in terms of any technological advantage and jump that Numeris may give the World Panel business compared to the peers that you mentioned, Nielsen and IRR, you mentioned the app kind of data, the speed and rich processing. Is that all like tech-enabled and tech-driven, or is it a different process, or is it a different process that makes it better?
The data in each market is collected slightly differently, but getting data through a mobile app is something we've spent a lot of time on already in Worldpanel. Worldpanel Plus is a few years old now, has been used. Is it as good as Numeris? Actually, it probably, it may not be. We need to do that detailed assessment. But we know there are other areas of technology in terms of, the data science team that we've got in Worldpanel would add a huge amount of value to the Numeris data. Their platform that's delivered to clients is probably better than the Worldpanel platform that gets delivered to clients. So I think one of the things I'm really looking forward to is when you get through all this process, is getting the teams together and working out, what could this business look like in 3 years, picking and choosing the best of both, and I think we could create something really quite special.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I think that's the last one. I'd just like to say thank you to everyone. Thanks for being patient, because we've been on the line for now nearly an hour and a half, so much appreciated and thank you.
Thank you so much, everyone. So that does now conclude your call for today. You may now disconnect, and thank you for joining.